The following podcast is brought to you by Rare Book School at the University of Virginia and sponsored by the Pine Tree Foundation of New York. To learn more about our programs and how you can support our school, please visit our website at www.rarebookschool.org. Thank you and enjoy.
I'd like to welcome you to our sixth lecture of the Rare Book School Summer Series, a series of lectures on book historical and bibliographical subjects sponsored by the Pine Tree Foundation of New York. But this is a unique lecture because it's the Rare Book School July 4th lecture, and what better person to give it than Matthew Brown, one of the true rising stars in American book history. He is the director of the University of Iowa Center for the Book and associate professor of English. He was a National Endowment for the Humanities Research Fellow at the Library Company in Philadelphia. He's been a Mellon Seminar leader several times, and at a very tender age, he was elected to full membership in the American Antiquarian Society, which is no trivial thing, believe me. Many of you will know Matt's book, The Pilgrim and the Bee, Reading Rituals and Book Culture in Early New England, published, I'm proud to say, by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2007, one of the best book historical presses in America. In that book, you will recall that Matt very inventively uses the insights of performance studies and allies them in clever and compelling ways to book history to think of new ways of thinking about American literary studies. Run, do not walk to your local bookstore if you haven't seen this yet. Matt's also the author of many articles. I'll only read the titles of 27 of them here. I'll give you the one with my favorite title: Book History, Sexy Knowledge, and the Challenge of the New Boredom. I don't know what that means we're in for today, but I hope we're going to get some book history, some sexy knowledge, and no new boredom. Matt was an important contributor to the Oxford Companion to the Book, and his scholarship goes on and on. Right now, he's working on a second book for which he has the NEH Fellowship. It's tentatively entitled The Novel and the Blank, and it's an investigation of how the constraints of the print shop affected the literary culture and reading habits of colonial and early national America. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Matthew Brown.
I want to look at the era that this holiday evokes. So it's going to be kind of less action, a little more auction. Less Madison, more the macaroni. And less red coat, and more red coat. A great variety. Our window into this will be Robert Bell, a Philadelphia bookseller and publisher. A great variety of curious and useful books, whether old or new, that has come out of it in the American world of books, may be had at Bell's bookstore near St. Paul's Church in 3rd Street, Philadelphia. This very excellent work of Milton's Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained, with poems on several occasions, two volumes, may now be had, priced $6, at Bell's bookstore in 3rd Street, Philadelphia, with every other curiosity that has come out of it in the American world of books. So reads the typical promotional language of publisher and bookseller Robert Bell. Bell, a Scottish emigre to the colonies by way of Dublin, worked in Philadelphia from 1768 to 1784. The pitch tells us something about Bell's values. He emphasizes the American world of books, the local world of native manufacture. He stresses the curious or intriguing volume, the title of his novel. And he labels his product, Come Out of It, attractive and accessible, available in social venues such as shops, auctions, and libraries. So this kind of courtship context, or romance context, I think is appropriate. That is, the word is not as awkward as it may seem. It appears in Ben Johnson's book, and Emma, by Jane Austen. So, and Bell's marketing, I think, is writing on this kind of association. From a modern perspective, this strikes us as utterly normal. A way to sell books, to diversify your product line, to promote local industry, to make things easy for the customer. But Bell marks a turn in the book culture of colonial and early national America. Bell published with a light touch, and he marketed with a heavy hand. In these roles, as publisher and marketer, Bell stands out. He printed imaginative literature and learned writing that had no necessary audience, and he sold titles with a circus barker personality that oriented itself to the purchaser. In taking risks, he took liberties, going beyond the customs and conventions of his early American predecessors. So what were these customs and conventions? Why is Bell different? In the colonial period, the key to printing success, if by that we mean staying in business, was job printing. As with Gutenberg and indulgences, and as Gutenberg famous for the Bible, but what got his business up and running and intact were printing what were once handwritten indulgences. So as with Gutenberg and indulgences, so too blanks, bills of lading, and legal forms animated print house production. Single sheet jobs such as these or almanacs, or by the 18th century newspapers, always took priority in the shop. Hugh Amory's careful statistical analysis in the colonial book in the Atlantic World attests to the importance of sheet counts generally. In a turn both pointed and admittedly arbitrary, James Green's scholarship, admitted by Jim, James Green's scholarship on Ben Franklin defined the book as a volume of 10 sheets or more. A costly venture that, given the capital that would be tied up in paper, the most expensive print house resource. Needless to say, printers sought to avoid such risks. The importance of non-book printing beyond early America or the early modern period has been measured as well. In surveying the 1907 census of production in Britain, Simon Elliott finds that books were worth some 14% of the total value of print production, with job printing and periodical printing accounting for the regular textual experience of English readers. The colonial, so that's just open for discussion about the role of non-book printing and how we did cultural history. So the colonial print house's reliance on government support made job printing all the more central in the context of the Atlantic periphery. For example, Ben Franklin first goes to London to secure a press because he thinks he'll be set up as a government printer. Colonial printers wanted the steady payments and secure politics of government jobs. Single sheet jobbing appealed to a colonial printer not because it was extremely lucrative, but because it supplied ready money in a cash poor trade and cash poor economy. So I'm conflating a lot there under jobbing. There's single sheet printing, there's blank forms, there's government printing, there's single sheet almanacs. These are all different, but none of them are publishing that has come out. That's just the broad strokes that I'm painting with you. And the difference I want to point out about that. What do these blanks look like? This is actually Franklin in debt. This is a blank bond where Franklin is owing 400 pounds. So if you know the autobiography, he preaches about that. Okay, it's printed. It's a manuscript here. Here's an indenture. Likewise, printed again. Such job printing was not without. I'll say more about this. Go forward here. Such job printing was not without its complications, nor without its aesthetics. Handbills and legal forms and currency required careful handling by compositors, correctors, and press workers. Attention to layout, multiple rows through the press, the incorporation of visual and verbal material. All of these practices were potentially laborious and were also motivated by graphic appeal. That is, the jobs might display the skills of the printer and sort of leverage more work. The blank forms themselves, bonds, indentures, bills of lading, and deeds, are instrumental or utilitarian works that entail handwriting for their completion. They are documents that mix manuscript and print. Jobbing is a kind of central but invisible part of cultural history. In restoring it recently to the attention of cultural history, plenty of bibliographers and others have worked on jobbing, so I don't need to over a 10th of Peter here, but in restoring it to the attention of cultural historian, more broadly speaking, Peter Scaligrass has recently discussed jobbing with the provocation that the printing revolution incited handwriting. That is, art and form sort of generated manuscript participation. Yet beyond correcting a certain kind of media history, that is, the this replaces that approach in the manuscript that it replaces the print culture, it's not clear to me what step forward is being made here. So it's this wonderful description that Peter knows the history, but culturally, what are the implications of this? And that's one thing this larger project is trying to think through. As to books and book selling, colonial printers would stock imports of dependable sort, of a dependable sort, textbooks, manuals, those works, and only occasionally risk publishing a volume of more than 10 sheets. So government printing, single sheet ephemera, mundane forms, script money in print, steady selling conduct books, such as the American world of books before Robert Bell. No wonder that we might say, along with its foremost scholars, that the period's book culture is, and I quote, poor, Hugh Amory, shallow, Hugh Amory again, and monotonous, Jim Green and Hugh Amory. Yet I think this perspective holds the era to a standard of a robust literary culture, not getting the textual world of job news to. The following frontispiece might weave better how we understand the value of text in colonial America. This is from George Wickham's penmanship manual, which Franklin's good friend, the scrivener Joseph Brightnell, ordered for the Library Company in 1733. So I'll read the caption, and you can sort of see it in the captions down here. This is, landscape format. That's a technical bibliographical term. I learned from Microsoft Word. So it's about 50 plates follow, and they're just gradings of holographic. So the caption down here begins with this image. The custom house keys and shipping denote trade, and the secretary's office, state affairs. The figure whose book is supported by time implies history, law, and poetry. And that venerable old man, in whose ear fame stands whispering, represents an ancient, celebrated penman. The boy below, who is studious and writing in his book, denotes youthful industry, and the figure above is the emblem of eternity, to intimate that penmanship will be valued and practiced as long as the world endures. Now, the framing architecture of the image emphasizes the locus of value in a culture of jobbing, that is, the custom house and the secretary. Male maturation, from industrious boy to celebrated penman, is heroized. The penman is called old and ancient, but he looks pretty vigorous with that beard, and he's active, like the boy, in the moment. Contrast them the emblem in the lower right corner, the figure of history, law, and poetry. Supported by a male character who clearly is ancient, the reader feminized and vulnerable with exposed breasts, holding a book that is awkwardly inoperable. And so, notice the gathering, sort of perpendicular to the gutter. Just kind of clutching the board for support, and her other hand far away from the image. This figure represents literature, history, law, and poetry. Right? This figure represents literature, the bellette, and learned writing associated with literary art. Relative to the static, independent figure, the penman and boy have currency. Thus, the frontispiece proclaims a commercial and bureaucratic world of text, where the printed word is demoted relative to manuscript, where handwriting orients power, and with where literature is at best for the ages, not of the moment. That's the exact thing. Now, blanks continue through something beyond. This is a bond from 1777. What's interesting here is that what I find very intriguing historically is historical artifacts. It's like, obviously, they're dating. They build in dating options for the future, right? So this is 1771, then you fill in what date you can mention. But this one is bracketed because it's clearly made before 1776, but signed 1777. And notice here, scratching out the language, a year of the reign of our sovereign Lord Drake, the third group. Okay, this is changing. So, this is my July 4th. Okay, sorry. All right. So, the job continues. But Robert Bell, he never prints a law, never prints an owner, or a newspaper. So, in his career, he ultimately dropped the plate. He's trained as a bookman, but in film, he establishes something valuable. Okay. Outside of the specialist literature, Bell is known for publishing Thomas Paine's Common Sense and the controversy ensuing from the author's disputes with the publisher, with Bell. Recent scholarship has provided searching commentary about Bell's activities. Beginning with Jim Green's foundational work on the colonial book in the Atlantic World, we have a portrait of Bell as a savvy, illustrated entrepreneur. Richard Scherer's The Enlightenment in the book captures the Bell alert to the market for key genres from the age of reason, law, science, and history. Sarah Knott taxed differently, using Bell as a kind of native informant for the culture of sentiment in British America. What I hope to add to this work is contact with Bell's imprints themselves. Rarely called on, these paratexts, the surround of the main text. These paratexts, his petitions and circulars, his filler and reprints, his editorial formatting, and even his annotations of the main text, present evidence of Bell's attitude toward publishing and marketing. And there's a relatively recent book by E. Taylor Bennett that gives some of this work. There's a whole inside baseball dispute I have in the she looks at his literature about war, his literature about Chesterfieldian plants. And I'm looking at him more as a kind of publisher. One offside by this talk, art and advertisement, I think will help us get into what Bell's like. So one offside art and advertisement from 1778 gives us the broad outlines of Bell's self-fashion and self-presentation. He labels himself provador to the sentimentalists and professor of book auctioneering. He targets his audience with descriptors suitable to the era's literary culture and with attempts at persuasion. He supplies reasoning for rationalists and reasoning for sentimentalists. And I like to tell my undergrads, it's like you know, when you're doing archival work with actual imprints or database recreation, you see historical actors using the language these are imposed and imported. So again, age of reason, age of feeling. You know, here, the Bell as a publisher is very much tapping into that. So you get a voice from the past presenting those terms rather than any sort of talking. He's using this language of the period. The rhetoric is in line with the titles he reprints, Blackstone's commentaries of all book, and Robinson's history of Charles V, or paired later in his career with a wave of popular novels associated with the cult of sensibility, Mackenzie, Rousseau, Goethe. Bell understands a readership attuned to enlightenment and to freedom. The outsized personality of Bell is rendered in the parallelism of Provador and Professor. The labor, faintly exotic diction of Provador seems to wink at the would-be transparent and felt emotion of the sentimentalist. Its cognate is purvey, and it suggests that such feelings are not so immediate that they require planning and supply. This is the business of sentiment and support. Professor of book auctioneering sounds almost vaudevillian, and perhaps reflects Bell's irreverence toward the title of learnedness. Charismatic auctioneering itself is one of Bell's innovations in the colonial market. While he will necessarily push certain titles, the auction is an arena of choice. Given his theatrical comportment, it understands how bookishness was not only a realm of solitary learning, but also a venue for sociable exchange. So manifest in Bell's persona is a book culture. Gear is a book culture geared to learning, leisure, and literary art, to voluntary reading, to selecting one title over another. Very different from the utilitarianness of the preceding generation. So just sort of broad focus. Bell's early reprints of imaginative literature in the American market reflect his entrepreneurship, while also typifying the formerly printer's cost-saving strategies. Here's the first title associated with Bell, not surprisingly, a joke book. Notice what becomes customary for Bell as language for his title. It's printed for purchases. Richard Schur, author of The Enlightenment book, calls this a curious habit, but I think we do better to see Bell making his mark within the genre of the colophon. He prints not for a patron and not for a bookseller, but rather isolates the purchaser as the target audience, mindful of the endpoint consumer who must be persuaded to buy. Another early reprint, his 12-number, 24-page, 1768 reprint of Oliver Goldsmith's The Traveler, uses similar the economical single-sheet printing for this relatively short poem means that Bell still must fill the pamphlet with copy. It's sure enough poem, even within that format, he still needs to fill the pamphlet with copy. In filler, he adverts to the added value the extra add-ons to the pamphlet, and to his more affordable parsing, as it's been a puff from Griffith's literary journal, and Mrs. Bell. Five editions of this poem without the matrimonial tale and the adventures of Tom Redhawk have been sold in Great Britain at no less price than 2 shillings and 6 pence of this currency. The matrimonial tale, or the double transformation as Goldsmith titled it, embeds within it a character, Jack Bookworm, especially germane to Bell's personality. The poem tells of the conversion of a coquette to a perfect beauty, but it begins with this male protagonist. And this is out of secluded from domestic strife, Jack Bookworm led a college life. A fellowship at 25 made him the happiest man alive. He drank his glass and cracked his joke, and frankly wondered as he spoke. This is a social type we made you familiar with. You know, Jack Bookworm and that in the audience. He's initially mad. Okay. We went flying. Yeah, right. So back to Jack Bookworm and the coquette, right? Marriage state. Cupid comes and shatters the scene of the fellowship. But Bell's attraction to the double transformation, he has other Goldsmith options, is perhaps in this opening figure, where bookishness is equal parts learning and sociability. Now, wit can play a normative role for Bell, as this marriage story indicates. His promotional voice creates an ideal reader and ideals of manhood. For example, in the first of Bell's surviving American catalogs from 1768, he excerpts and rewrites John Gay's fable of the elephant and the bookseller. But he just reduces it to 6 lines. Most of it from Gay, but some variants. An elephant invades of yore, rummaged the shop of learning board, the page he with attention spread, and wisely thought on what he read. Not like some modern coxcomb's minding, only the margin's breadth and binding. So that substitutes modern coxcombs for modern dealers in the sorts, suggesting a way to distance himself as a dealer, right, from the message of the fable, while also denigrating attention to fine packaging. He also adds to Gay's fable the line, and wisely thought on what he read. In the original, the elephant is being recruited by the bookseller to write like history of Siam. You know Greek, write a controversial tale about controversial response to the Trinity. So it's a very different sort of dramatic setting for this. The bookseller comes off rather poorly in this source. It's not even a seller in Bell's tradition. So, in rewriting it, it's wisely thought of what he read. In the original, there's no wise reflection. There's just the elephant disagreeing, having a conversation with the bookseller. So, it's more extreme. In that, he prescribes, in Bell's revision, he prescribes reflection as a kind of key component of the reading. The same catalog features an extended verse rendition of the Antoine Boudreau fable, 2 books, and that's the handout. The verse most likely is Bell's invention. This is decorative. I'll talk about it a little bit, but I know attention can wander, so hopefully this will give you entertainment. I'm just going to talk a little bit about it. So, 2 books placed, this is how it begins, 2 books placed, 9, in a bookshop. The one, a gilded turkey fop. The other's dress was somewhat plainer, being humbly clothed with blue taper. the coxcomb proud of his laced coat, curled up his nose, and thus he spoke. And speak he does, the foppish book heaps scorn on his mate. How can a gentleman dressed like me endure with such scoundrel company, and the like? Now, plain Quaker then, with truth replied, your laced red coat has raised your pride. And that's what Gary drew, like in the film version of this. The red coat then demands that the bookseller move his meaner brethren away from him. The story concludes when a purchaser, up blue cover, lifts and eyes him, turns over his page, admires and buys him. Bell varies this fable for a local audience, right? Red coat and plain Quaker have no precedent in the French original or the English translations. The fable's moral about the gaudy book, void of inward merit to attract fox and coxcombs, place it on their back, sends at least two messages. It instructs purchasers about their proper role, that only fox display their books, and it recommends the internalization of content, the inward merit of the book. It also thus continues this pattern of deriding the appreciation of fine books. And in that, it arguably constructs a kind of norm of masculinity, the fop, the dandy, the costume, and the macaroni. All were images of effeminacy, which would play all the more in the early National American period as a way to define manhood against European stereotypes. So, and the orbiting of this is the Yankee Doodle Dandy. You know, I mean, it's originally a loyalist song, right, intended to just sort of derive the colonial troops. And then the troops themselves take it up and they're kind of appropriate it and take it back to the crop. Well, Bell's doing the same kind of thing here, but dissing, you know, trying to diss the British with this kind of thing. So, the classic definition of wit in the 18th century, imagination tempered by judgment, combines with the public, sociable, enlightened, and direct demeanor of Bell to highlight his mode of straight male self-presentation. The stage for this self was the auction. Bell was a larger-than-life auctioneer. We get a taste of his pattern and style from the circulars and documents used in his career. And again, we see his innovations in the American market. A memo in support of a 1774 petition to the Pennsylvania Assembly to authorize book auctions argues that, quote, the desire of the book purchasers deserves to be considered as well as the desire of book sellers. And it's competing with booksellers, but again, you see this sort of reader-oriented approach. More readers, writes Bell, have been lifted under the literary standard in 1 week by the well-known invitation of, gentlemen, please walk into the auction. Books are now going for half price. Pray, gentlemen, step into the auction. Then can be lifted in 7 years by the dull mode of, sir, I assure you, it costs 12 shillings sterling in London, and I cannot take a copper less than 25 shillings currency. Mr. Niplo sells them at that, and Mr. Noodle too, therefore, I cannot take one copper less than 25. So for Bell, auctions provided cash on the barrel head for a strapped printer, thus benefiting literary readers in this type of thing. Those sales by auction, although at an underprice, realize its dead stock into a lot of cash, and would sooner enable him to repair with ready money to the paper manufacturers in order to make another attempt upon some celebrated author whose sublime works might diffuse universal knowledge to every corner of the American economy. So Bell was reader-centered as well in melodramatically claiming that at the of the exhibition, books will then instantaneously either be sold or sacrificed. Customers must act or lose the chance of a title. Now, Bell's contention was that sales beget sales, whereby the magical mallet, what are you talking about? This image of the auction, the magical mallet let books skip from shelf to shelf, again, Bell's words, helping the cause of learning, feeling, and then language. Bell's language and attitude feature in the annotating and formatting of his reprints. Bell published the first American edition of Paradise Lost in 1777, but it is his 1770 miscellany of Milton prose tracts that is perhaps more striking. He presents in full entitled An Old Looking Glass He presents in full considerations of the likeliest means to remove hirelings from the church. This is a 1659 template by Milton. And then compiles extracts from Of Reformation, an apology for Smexinius, and Canon of Persians. These are some anti-clerical essays and passages that deliver a Milton on, according to Bell's preface, the gospel method of rewarding its preachers. The topical context is an ongoing debate about tithes and payment of ministers and income levels for clergy. The overt motive in Bell's preface is to make Milton's message accessible. He refers to the collected works editions from 1698 to 1754, comparing how his edition is as accurate as those, while making this obscure one found only in such multi-volume works or for. Yet his repurposed Milton portrays Bell's concerns, both business and cultural. These concerns are revealed in footnotes Bell feels compelled to add to Milton's track. So here's main text, Milton's considerations, and then Bell stepping into the footnote. The context, I should say, just the main text context, is Bell is here criticizing pastoral work that he thinks could just be work done through careful attention by the ways into scripture rather than to pastors. And then I'll just read through. The founder of Christianity has said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The practice of many of the modern clergy illustrates this maxim. With barefaced impudence, they retail their nefarious Sunday half-hour speeches, tongue-tied and dumb, except when they steal. With regard to the sublime, elevating and enlightening truths of the everlasting gospel. Because their hearts are far estranged from it. Would you be pleased without a miracle to hear the dumb speak only change the subject from spiritual to temporal things, mentioned but the reduction of clergymen's salaries, ecclesiastical taxes, tithes, and their large church revenues, then will you hear their tongues fully unloosed, and they will talk extemporary for whole hours to them, because in these earthly, carnal, and sensual things, their hearts are wholly interested. So its critique of ministerial power reflects in part Bell's Enlightenment ethics, and he evidently saw a market for this literature of controversy. But what is striking is Bell's animus around public speech and self-interest. I mean, there's an excess here, that's what I'm trying to read. Much of the early national era will see a contest for cultural authority between novelists and ministers. Captain Davidson has written on the idea that early American novels build into their narration narrators who are essentially moral to try to counteract the effect of the ministers who are saying, don't read fiction, don't read novels. So you have a kind of war for cultural authority there. And I think something similar might be going on here. It's always, I guess it's what I'm trying to get at, this animus towards the clergy. That is, the Sunday half hour, so here I think you see Bell waging a war between publishers and ministers rather than, say, novelists and ministers. The Sunday half hour speeches contrast with the extempore entertainment of the Enlightenment auctioneer. Bell may see his mirror image as well, getting paid for diffusing universal knowledge. That's his Enlightenment sort of foundation or baseline, rather than, say, scriptural truth from the ministers. So, his business concerns are also revealed. So that's the cultural anxiety, I guess, that is going on there. But business concerns are revealed in this note, and another note is extended concern about laborers to be fairly compensated. So, from Bell's perspective and experience, book-selling publishers swapping out church pulpit for auction podium are due to the audience given to them. Bell's belief in literary art. This is my last example. Bell's belief in literary art did not prevent him from strong-handed editing that perhaps undermined the effect of literary art. His clumsy formatting in the first American edition of Mackenzie's classic novel, Sensibility of the Man of Feeling, reveals a businessman's interest, though perhaps short-term. Mackenzie's work presents the fiction of a compiling editor whose preface begins the novel. Bell harms the critique by inserting an ad down here, an ad for another novel of Senator Emma Corbett in the blank space ad for the preface. The conceit of the novel is also to indicate missing chapters as the reader proceeds. But Bell ruins this strategy by presenting a table of contents to totally incoherent. I mean, the process of seeing it sort of comes with. So, but I think what he's doing, he's trying to divert the fact that he has filler. This is, we've got extras here that will make it more appealing. He ruins the strategy by presenting a table of contents. This is a variant from any of the 10 British editions of the 4 French that preceded it. So, it allows Bell to show the added value of appended works to the beginning of the volume, though it disrupts the immersive experience of sensibility's fiction world. So, the legacy then of Bell's liberties. On the one hand, I think, his idea of auctioneering, salesmanship, a way in which sales beget sales, seems like a positive force for diffusing knowledge. On the other hand, less entranced with his gender norms, the liberties he takes in that fashion. But one of the last traces we have of Bell brings us home, as it were, and this is to the point. An anecdote from Chesterloo's travels in North America, a French officer who wrote on this. Traveling from 1780 to 1782 evokes a Bell we've met so far, but with an important final lesson about book culture's legacy. In a passage about the expense of staying in inns during a war, so even after the abolition of paper money and when all payments were made in specie, Chesterloo's translator recalls one of Bell's strategies. An absence of currency. The translator had once given Bell an Irish copy of Sheridan's School for Scandal, with the prologue and epilogue taken from Dodsley's Annual Register, which Bell reprinted for a dollar. This assemblage of reprinting is no surprise, but the translator continues. In traveling through Virginia, some months after, I was surprised to see, in many of the inns, even in the most remote parts of the country, this celebrated copy, School for Scandal. And upon inquiry, found that Mr. Bell had passed in his way to the Springs and successfully circulated, in payment, this new species of paper currency. For as Bell observed, who would not prefer Sheridan Sterling to the counterfeit creations of Congress, or even the Robert Morris? So printed matter, coin of the realm, indeed printed imaginative writing so valued, the sociable space of the inn as a place for literary experience, even the alliterative balance of Sheridan Sterling and counterfeit creations. The anecdote is pure Bell. Most importantly, is the way the wit itself serves, if it inadvertently, a legacy function, whereby the copies remain in ends, part of a posterity, a cultural inheritance. In its small way, Bell's reprint of Sheridan reminds us of the mission of RDS and of the humanities writ large, that is, to preserve, transmit, and interpret our cultural deposits. Of this comedy turned cash, the Chesterfield passage concludes, nor was any depreciation attempt where the intrinsic value is so unequivocally stained with the character of wit and freedom. So not to sell or sacrifice in Bell's hyped up money, but rather to cherish and protect it. Thank you.